Hi, welcome to another episode of the CTO to CTO podcast. TechCrunch's recent news of Polish-American startup Sailor raising $2.5 million in seed funding went viral a couple of days ago. In this week's Pioneers episode, Piotr speaks to Filip Dames, entrepreneur and investor at Cherry Ventures, the VC that made this and many other impressive investments happen since it was founded in 2013. Piotr and Filip talk the founder's first, investor's second motto, investing in open source products, and most important criteria for becoming a Cherry VC portfolio company. Philip also expands on the key qualities for a successful founder beyond just having a vision and being confident in your projects, and reveals which investments he's missed and which he's most proud of. Tune in.
Hi there. Today my guest is Filip Dames, co-founder of Cherry VC. Cherry's founders have been involved in Zalando, Quandu, and Groupon, and the fund has previously been among the first backers of Auto1, Flixbus, Flash & Post, Dash, Reki, Emboss, and many others. We are going to dig into how Cherry works, how to become the portfolio company, what makes the founding team successful, and how investing in developers' tools and open source differs from the other software companies. Hi, Filip. Thank you for accepting my invitation.
Hi. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
First of all, I would like to start with, I guess, very important point in your curriculum, which is Zalando. You were in the very, very early, funding team of the project. What are your key learnings from Zalando?
Yeah, so, I mean, Zalando continues to be an amazing company. I mean, I left the company with the IPO in 2014. And they just published their numbers this week, and the company's incredible, right? Targeting 30 billion GMV. And still sort of super innovative on opening new markets. And if you ask me what are the key success factors or like maybe the things that we've learned, I think two things stick out, right? I think you realize this as an operator and you realize this as an investor. First, the team makes all the difference. So I think what Zalando has done really well is thrive for a culture of trust and transparency, adding people to the mix that are different, that are better than the people that are already in the company. And that's, I think, something that Zalando has done super well.
Yeah.
And then I think the second thing that really matters was timing as well, right? So Zalando was a winner of the last financial crisis, 2008. We got started. The advertising budgets were down. Nobody was really doing any marketing. And Zalando acted very fast and sort of became the winner of this. And I think this is also generally something that we will now see with COVID, is the company who act fast and the companies who act with conviction once things are starting to pick up again will be able to capture significant market shares regardless of the industry. And that's definitely something that happened in the case of Zalando as well.
Awesome. You said the team, and let me stick to this for a moment before we get further. I mean, I had Jan Hegewar from Zalando. He was my guest 6 episodes ago, something like this. And then Victoria Schimeyer, who ran the Zalando pre-owned project. And those two talks were absolutely great. The people were great, and they told me something like, yeah, the culture is the differentiator, the way we are led to do our things, not being too much push on the numbers, too much push like with the constraints. We have a lot of freedom, but we are all motivated into the same direction. So that's super cool. So I guess you put a lot of effort into building this culture.
For sure. I think it's about empowering people and letting them take responsibility. And I think by doing that, you will, we'll just create much better outcomes than by micromanaging people. And I think that's super key.
What were your tools for implementing such a culture? I mean, different companies do it a different way. I mean, OKRs, onboarding process, very tailored to your company, a lot of different tools. I know from Devante that we struggled for, I can say, a couple of years into finding the right set of tools that are natural for the people and also very effective. What was the key at Zalando?
I think this has also evolved over time with the teams getting much bigger. But even when we started and when the team was very small, to promote a culture where failing was allowed,
gotcha.
Right? This is absolutely mm-hmm. important. So people weren't afraid of experimenting, of trying out new things, a culture where you would be able to invest a certain amount of your time also in moonshot topics, maybe things that weren't part of your daily business, but allow you to sort of think beyond the day-to-day. And yeah, of course, we also had tools like OKRs and stuff, but I think generally more important is, I think, the management style that you have towards your people, is that you really enable them and they have the feeling that they are trusted and their contribution is taken serious.
Gotcha. That makes perfect sense. Now you are building Cherry PC, dealing with a lot of different teams. I suppose that you are getting thousands of inquiries from startups or different sort of product companies over the month as you go. And the culture is something you are also putting huge priority on picking the companies, like to get into Cherry VC. Is it more important to have a great product or having great founders?
I think both is important. So the thing is, we are very focused on seed, that is a really, really important part of our strategy, and we can talk about this later. But typically when we invest, there are some things to look at, but we spend most of our time actually on the team, and I think we're going to talk more about them, like what makes a successful founder and what are the traits that we're looking for. But at the end of the day, as a VC, you have to think about the potential outcome if everything goes right. Right. So if everything happens like you are dreaming, it could happen, then what would be the outcome of that company? And I think when it comes to team, it's important to look at it in a way. It's like, if everything goes right, so if all the circumstances, if all the stars are aligned, is this the team that could build it? And I guess that's sort of the most important question that we have to ask ourselves.
Yeah, that's a very interesting answer. Not that long ago, I had a conversation from other colleague from different VC, and we were discussing one particular project, which is enterprise software for managing the products for e-commerce, and we were discussing if it's what are the USPs of this product, tech trends, not. The team, maybe. And I was asking him, like, man, you need to do such a difficult choices as a VC, which one to invest, which one not, because you are making this choice before they got the right traction, usually.
And I think if you think about it, like, if you have the choice to invest in a great team in a product that's maybe not perfect, and in a mediocre team that's maybe a little bit further ahead with product, you always go for the better team, right? Because they also, they will be more flexible when it comes to, changing strategies, changing roadmap, replying to customer demands and so on. So I think team definitely, especially at an early stage, but actually, to be honest, across all stages is most important.
It's pretty much like with hiring, right? I heard this famous quote, and I really like it when I was into HR at Devante, that you simply don't find, don't search for, you don't motivate people, you search for motivated people. And it's the same with teams. You search for the right teams, not trying to build one because it's not a casting or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's generally true. And I think also something as investors, you have to remind yourself, right? You are not building these companies. The founders and the founding team are building the companies. You can only support. You can also only be the sparring partner, right? So, and with hiring, the same, right? I think you, as a founder, one of the biggest skills, or the most important skills that you need to develop, is like the ability to hire top talent. If you don't get that right, your company will fail at the end of the day, right? So the best founders are able to identify people that are better than them in certain dimensions and get them excited about the project and get them on board, right? So
absolutely, that's absolutely a huge point. Okay, let's take a step back because we went into people, into what makes the founding team successful a little bit, but let's take a step back. Back in the day, you exited Zalando with a huge success, and how you got into VC. You know, it's, for me, it's a little bit, you know, pivot of your career, because from being entrepreneur, founder into operations, you know, all this company stuff, you got into investing. How was this change for you? What motivated you to start Sherry?
Yeah, so for me, the entrepreneurial journey started even before Zalando. So I had a first startup when I moved to Berlin, and that company failed, right? It was not a success. And then, you know, afterwards, I joined the Zalando team. And of course, that was a very different trajectory. And I think both experiences taught me a lot. And after Zalando, I actually thought about, okay, what is the next company I'm going to build? And, you know, as most sort of serial entrepreneurs would do, you know, started making lists of interesting business models and so on. And in the meantime...
You mean you were searching for an idea for like typical company? I mean, like... Normal, not investing fund, nothing like this, like startup.
A regular startup. Startup. So, at some point I was already, you know, I wanted to do something in the US potentially. I had lots of different ideas. And in the meantime, I kept investing. I kept angel investing. And we had lots of, you know, founders that came to us asking for advice and that's sort of how our first couple of investments, they just happened, right? So I didn't really plan them, but it was like very much based on teams and founders that inspired me, and I was excited about what they wanted to build. And that's how we built our first angel portfolio. That was still during my time also, even before that, during my time at Zalando, I already started angel investing. We kept investing and then actually realized how much fun we had doing it. And at the end of the day, the idea behind Cherry was then to build the VC firm that we would have liked to have by our side as a founder.
Gotcha.
And that was the vision. That was the big idea. And so in a way, Cherry is also a startup, right? We are not just, you know, wiring money somewhere, but we are really building a firm, and we think very hard about how do we build a brand, how can we add value to our portfolio, what is sort of the value add that our founders appreciate the most and is most helpful. So in a way, that's also a company we're building.
Gotcha. I read your claim that Sherry VC is founder first, investor second. What does it exactly mean?
Yeah, so we say this because with everything we do, with every way we design the companies, we design Cherry, we try and have the founder in mind. So we see us, as I said, we don't want to build their companies. At the same time, we see us as true sparring partners on eye level. Like, so with every interaction, we put ourselves in the founder's shoes and think like, what is the best way to act here as an investor? Yeah. And also like what we're optimizing for. The single most important KPI for Cherry is founder NPS, so Net Promoter Score. So will our founders recommend us to other founders? And we believe that we're not the only ones that are doing it. This term got coined by the benchmark team. I think it is absolutely key for if you want to be successful in venture long term, is that for me, that is the only strategy that will win sort of long term.
I think that's pretty unique. I heard many different KPIs for VCs, cash on cash, the multipliers, the ROI, exits.
I think that will all come from founder NPS. I think this is the thing.
Yeah, it's a long run game, right? You need to keep meeting the best founders, and the best way is to get them from records, from recommendations, and that makes perfect sense for me. Talking about this criteria and KPIs, maybe let's talk about the criteria for the startups to get onboarded with Cherry. What are those criteria, and what's your investment strategy?
Yeah, so on the investment strategy, as I said, we're very focused on seed rounds. So we're typically the first institutional check into a company, and that's what we're best at. And that's it will stay this way, right? So on the criteria, VC is an outlier game, right? So it is quite a strange game, to be honest. You look for outliers, right? So you think about the company that you're investing in, and you think about like what could that company become if everything goes right. And you need to believe that they can sort of become a unicorn. It's a little bit crazy, right? And we obviously know that not all of our companies will become unicorns at the end, but the potential needs to be there, right? So that then comes down also to the ambition level of the team, right? We would probably not invest if the founder says, hey, look, I'm looking to build a nice business that, you know, pays me a nice dividend at the end of the year. And if I'm really lucky, I can sell it for 20 or 50 million. There's nothing wrong with that at all. But that company is probably not a venture case, not a case for us.
I have heard that VCs very often have a criteria that every single company need to pay off the whole fund. Is it something like this? What you are just...
Yeah. Whether you define it in absolute valuation that the company could get to, or where you relate it to your fund size, and you say the single investments need to be able to return the fund, I think the strategies are quite similar.
Okay, and is it oriented into some specific verticals, or is it more generalistic?
So we're a generalist fund, but stage focused. So Within the team, we have our areas of expertise, and we have our focus as well. So we're going to talk about open source. We're going to talk about dev tools. This is an area where I spend a lot of time. And I also work a lot with fintech companies. And then the last area where I have where I spend a portion of my time is within digital health. Okay. So this is me, but then my partners are looking at completely different things. So this is also the way we develop our thought leadership internally. So we try and go really, really deep on specific industries, understand the value chain in large detail, or like very deep detail, and then look where in the value chain do we see sort of potential for disruption through technology. And then we oftentimes turn it around, and we actually do a lot of outbound. So we find our founders rather than, looking for them to write to us. And so in the case of Sailor that we spoke about earlier, I actually reached out to Mirek on LinkedIn because I saw that traction on GitHub. I saw, how the company was developing, and I really liked what I saw. So I was just, picking him to have a chat, to get to know each other. And, a few months later, that ended up being one of our investors.
Awesome. You mean Mirek from Sailor, because before recording, we were discussing this pretty fresh news today on TechCrunch that Cherry VC backed Sailor. And we get into this particular project in a couple of minutes. But first, let me just wrap it up. Or maybe you're going to help me to wrap it up. Let's say I'm a founder of company looking for some VC money to grow, right? And as you said, probably it's better that you find me than I apply to Cherry directly, because it's probably more chances to have a fit. But what does it exactly mean? Like, what my company should be doing, should be having to be a perfect fit to Cherry VC? Like, I'm a founder, you meet me, ask a few questions, and write off the check. So what are the criteria for this situation to happen?
Okay. So of course, you know, not all of our companies that we invest in are outbound, or we find them through outbound. We get actually a couple of thousand applications per year, and we look at all of them. So I think the first thing, if you want to get in touch with us, is like try and find a way to stand out. Don't write to, you know, team@cherry.com. We don't have the team, frankly. It's not because we don't want to, but we don't have the capacity to look at everything in detail. So try and find a way, have someone that knows someone that knows someone that can make an introduction. And I think there you will already sort of really increase the probability or the likelihood that we would invest. And I think the criteria, I think it comes down to what we just discussed. So like, what is your ambition level as a founder? Like, what do you think you can build, and do we believe in that vision? Yeah. Right. And, of course, there are certain markets that we're more interested in than others, and that also plays a role. But in overall, I would say most important is the founding team and its ambition level.
Okay, so that's I think that's fair enough. Like, okay, it's not the direct receipt how to get funded by Cherry, but I think it's fair enough. It's good, you know, a roadmap. Okay, so. You said funding team is the key success factor. What makes the funding team successful, and maybe even going further, what makes the founder successful? Like, is there a set of you know features of character that makes successful founders, and how you see it? Do you see any pattern in the companies you invested in and they succeeded?
It's a very good question, because there is also no clear answer to it, right? There's many, many different archetypes of successful founders. I think there's a few commonalities that I believe hold mm-hmm. true. One is experience matters,
okay.
Right? Experience matters. If you have a founder that has built a successful business before, like you, there's around 30% chance that they will be successful again. If it is a founder who failed at their prior business, the chance is around 20%, so still pretty good. And if it's a first-time entrepreneur, it's actually
you calculated it based on some historical data.
I don't know what the underlying data sources is,
but okay, it's good.
Whether it's 20 or 18, I think at the end of the day,
it's good. I have 30%.
I
have 30%.
Yeah,
that's
30%.
It's not bad. What makes the you know lasting 70% of my success?
Yeah, and then I guess the second thing, right, we look for is sort of, we call it founder market fit.
Founder market fit, yeah.
Right? So it is maybe great founder, but is there a founder market fit? So is this particular founding team best positioned to win in this particular industry, and why?
Yeah.
And I think if you can answer that question, that's already a
second
pass.
So you mean that probably I have a better chances in e-commerce than, for example, in medtech, right?
Probably yes. And if you ask yourself that question, you would probably answer way also.
Okay.
And then like you're asking like character traits, which I think is the most difficult one.
Yeah.
I think Jeff Bezos said like something like we're stubborn on vision, but we're flexible on details, right? So I think this is really, really interesting, right? So
I know some companies that are have opposite in them, roles, that they are flexible on vision and stubborn on detail.
Yeah, that is a much more difficult combination. Yeah. Also, and I think with vision, obviously, you need to be adaptable. But I think you have to have a vision that you follow, and that vision, needs to be sort of the North Star of what you're doing. And then, like great founders that we see, they typically have that, and they have that confidence as well. At the same time, they have a strong gut feeling, so able to follow their instinct. Yeah. It's about sort of being a hustler, right? Being fearless. I think building a company is hard, right? I mean, most companies fail. We know this. And even the successful companies, and that's something that I think people always forget, because then they look at the news and see, wow, this company IPO'd. Even the successful companies, it's a roller coaster, right? It's ups and down for every company. And so I think you need to be built for that.
Gotcha.
And then I think the maybe.
So the grit is also very important.
Yeah, the hustle, the grit, however you want to call it, exactly. And then I think one thing is a key commonality for strong founders is their level of empathy towards people and their ability to hire and attract top talent to their business. I think if a founder doesn't have that, high chance they're not going to be successful.
So he or she needs to be good at sales, also in HR. Like HR is reverse selling.
Yeah. At the end of the day, everything is sales in this category.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Okay, let's go on. I have another topic which is super interesting for me by obvious reasons. I think it's very very interesting for our listeners too. It is in general investing into open source, investing into developer tools. I think that those two strategies are not always in line, but you do both. And the latest, you know, news of VC, like Share VC investing into Sailor, is just about that, open source and dev tools. So
yeah,
maybe let's start with Sailor. Like, why did you decide to invest into guys? Other than, you know, they are great founders and great team men.
Yeah, you know them,
right?
They live
around
the corner. Yeah. Look, a couple of things. I think if you look at the macro, and this was especially true last year, it's like there's a huge shift towards online penetration, right? So this is, I think, you know this from Devanta, you know this from your companies, it's like this is an unstoppable trend.
Never happened before at such a pace, you know? Last year was crazy.
No. I think last year, the acceleration that we've seen on both ends of the spectrum, right? So on the one hand, consolidation, right? With Amazon being responsible for, I think it's around 45-47% of total online retail in the US. So on the one hand, huge consolidation. On the other hand, completely new target group that is moving online and then that sees their online presence not only as a sort of a side hustle or something additional to their core, but as the actual core. That's sort of the one trend that we're seeing. And on the other hand, what we also see is the decision maker in a company when it comes to architecture decisions, when it comes to platform decisions, is shifting away from the business leader or the CIO to the developer.
Gotcha.
So we're seeing a lot of these like bottom-up adoption plays that are happening across different industries, API businesses. We're going to talk about open source and why we like that. And retail is no exception, right? So within retail, and then we saw this team with their focus on execution, with their focus on technological excellence, so to say, and their adoption, early adoption within the community, which really excited us. And that was basically then the reason we invested, right, in Mirik and Patrick, because we were really impressed by what the two had built at such a young age.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Sailor has a really great fit to at least three tech trends. I also see growing like a hell. I mean, GraphQL, Python, and Headless. And it's open source, and they are building cloud. So it's amazing what they've done in just, you know, a few years, actually. So that's awesome. But open source and developer tools, I think that those two categories of products different a lot from typical software products. I mean, especially open source, but dev tools as well. I mean, in dev tools, you have a situation where you attract the folks that are not always decision makers on spending the money. This is something you just said, contrary to what I'm saying right now, that it's changing and the tech people, CTOs, devs have more to say, but it's still, you know, it's still like they can spend $500 maybe, but they won't spend like $10,000, right, for a license. It's almost impossible. They need to convince the business guys still. So that's one.
Yes. But yeah. I think the first thing I think is to clarify that, you know, not all successful DevTools startups follow the open source adoption model.
Absolutely.
Right? And yeah. I think cloud computing has made it increasingly possible for proprietary, but also for non-open source models to reach developers. And there's really, really big examples there in the market, right? If you look at the Twilio, for example, or if you look at the Stripe, so they didn't follow the open source adoption model.
But they have huge community.
Exactly. And I think this bottom-up market adoption is something that is fundamentally changing the way that enterprises look at software, right? And I think whether it's in enterprise infrastructure where you have like databases, you have, you know, analytics stacks like a Hadoop, or whether it's in sort of code development process infrastructure like a GitHub or a Docker, you have the budgets that are shifting to developers. And you're right, maybe that's not always the case with sort of super expensive budget, but these projects typically aren't super expensive, right? So I think what I'm most excited about, it's sort of this movement that purchasing power has shifted from the traditional CIOs to the developer. The developer is now at the center of decision making for the adoption of almost any product. And they're basing their decisions based on the quality, on the ease of use, the scalability. And that is a new distribution for enterprise, right? And the beautiful thing is, like, you know, we're coming from consumer, but you can almost argue that you see similar adoption patterns than you see in consumer businesses in these sort of bottom-up / open source business models.
Yeah, that's interesting. I also had that, you know, that was one of the greatest things about the Atlassian and their business model. Because beforehand, I'm not sure if our listeners remember it, but I remember it pretty well. I was using Confluence first time in 2006, and it was like, I made this decision, you know. I implemented this as the software company I was working at as a developer, like regular developer, you know, nothing fancy, nothing C-level, nothing like this. I just started using it, and the team followed, and they simply cannot say no, like the business guys. They must buy this license. And this is how they changed the way enterprise software is being adopted. And I see a lot of these patterns. Even, you know, we have this open loyalty platform, which is not exactly open source. It's a mixed model. So up to one, like some number of users, I don't remember the exact number, is open source, is MIT. But after crossing this number, you need to pay the license. So it's working like a kind of Trojan horse, you know, something like this.
And I think it's also... the interesting part is sort of like who consumes and who contributes to open source, right? This is something that, you know, especially in like larger companies, that also has changed, right? It's now also an important tool for enterprises to attract the best engineers. Yes. And it's become a hiring factor. So people are like engineers are encouraged to contribute to these projects, right? And that's also why a lot of the interesting sort of open source projects of the last couple of years were actually created within bigger tech companies, right? And there, you know, they could develop, people were adopting them internally. And before they were actually ever going into monetization or commercialization, so to say, they just had time to evolve and use.
But this, are you afraid of, I name it, of the Docker case? Because, you know, Docker case for me is super interesting failure case in the end. Because, you know, they started with this containerization before it became a thing. You know, it became fashionable, and, you know, anyone started using it in production and so on. They started the thing with Docker. Docker was kind of synonym for containers for very, very long time before Kubernetes took off the market. No problem. And the cloud providers took the rest of this market. And in the end, Docker, it's not, you know, it's not commercial success anymore. They created a standard, the industry standard, how the hosting is working right now, you know, how the application distribution is working, but they are not taking any benefits of that. For me, it's the worst case scenario for OpenSUSE success.
That is, that, of course, and that is the big risk, right? That still is the risk for any open source product. If you look at the big cloud providers, if you're monetizing via cloud, I mean, they could just, you know, take it and offer it themselves. And I think this is, you know, there is always some you know, disadvantages that you need to balance out. At the same time, I think the core advantages in the distribution model in the adoption. Yeah. And then you can sort of build a business on top of that.
You mean, for example, doing the monetization via cloud model, right? So it's still open source, but...
Via cloud. I mean, we see different things, right? So typically in open source, right, you start sort of with consulting revenue, like a bit of sort of support, packaging and so on.
I guess consulting revenues is nothing fancy for VC, right?
No, because it doesn't scale, right? That's a problem. But usually it doesn't scale. It can be a very successful, profitable business, but it doesn't really scale, right? So then you have sort of the open core model. And then you have sort of this cloud SaaS offering that you can then, you know, build on top of that. And I think different things work for different companies. Of course, it doesn't come. The advantages don't come without disadvantages. That's for sure.
That's absolutely true. I think that you need to mix it. I mean, we were testing a lot this open source plus cloud model. It works okay-ish, but it's still like you are competing with yourself, with your self-product, because there's always this, you know, tension, like, agencies, developers, let's say for e-commerce platforms, as we are discussing here, the agencies, you know, they always have this idea that maybe we're going to host it on our own servers, on maybe on AWS, whatever, but why to pay for the cloud? Meaning, I'm trying to say that you need to mix it and have this open source, have this cloud, but also on the cloud, it's actually good to have some obviously, you know, difficult to build features that are barrier for the guys to not use just the open source, but actually to pay you for the license.
Exactly.
Open close plus cloud. Yeah, open core plus cloud.
Exactly.
That was super cool conversation. Thanks for your views on that. That's super interesting. My next question actually was, which business models work best from VC perspective? I mean, for open source, we have on-prem, consulting, cloud, and mixed. And we already said that probably cloud and mixed, some kind of mixed model is a fit. The other question that I have on my mind is, have you seen any successful pivot from purely open source towards business model? I mean, you know, you have successful open source, a lot of GitHub stars, let's say 100, you know, production users using your software, even at a scale. Is there a chance to implement a business model, or is it the wrong way and you should just have it, this business model, on your mind from the day zero?
Good question. So I do think, I mean, open source companies can take a long time, right? So if you look at sort of the big ones, like an Elasticsearch, right? Where you see sort of like it was built sort of early 2000s when the work on it started. And then, you know, once sort of the product Elastic was out, it was already sort of a relatively mature technology with a huge following, right? And a strong community. So I think you have a bunch of examples like that, that these sort of open source projects, they evolve into businesses so they actually evolve from an pure open source project into an actual business. And then I think the second thing is like you see a lot of them are being created in labs as well from universities like Databricks, Spark, and within sort of bigger companies. And then you also see a lot of spin-offs, right? You see a lot of agencies. And I think that was also the case with Sailor, with Miromi. At some point, they got repeating the customer demands for like highly scalable infrastructure, started building and looking into their own stuff. And then, you know, from that sort of the idea of Sailor emerged. So I think that that is something I see a lot, is like more this evolution, I would say, rather than, you know, just pivot.
That's really interesting. When I spoke with the Gabriel Engel, founder of Rocket Chat, they had pretty much the same situation. I mean, Rocket Chat is super popular, open source. He hated when I name it like open source Slack, because it's way more. But you know, obviously it's kind of competition for Slack, but it's open source. And they pivoted, like it was purely open source. They pivoted into commercial, like they have open source still and commercial version. And he told me something. I think that it's exactly what you just said, maybe different wording, because he said, if somebody has budget, he gonna buy it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's obvious because they get SLA, they get some features, authorization, user identification, support for LDAP or active domains or whatever, you know, and your enterprise users need. And the other guys, if we were just proprietary, just commercial, they simply won't use it.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of different use cases, and some of them evolve, some of them just need to get some love from us. I mean, the open source version. So yeah, I think that it's good to be open for this evolution. You don't have to have this business model
from the start.
That is zero. I totally agree.
Yeah.
And that's for sure. Okay, the other thing you also mentioned are the spin-offs. I mean, you have agency, you have software house, you build on the product on the side, which is, you know, very often a case, because you saw some use case repeating over and over and over, and you just make it once and for all, like a product or a library or whatever. And then it's getting to grow. It's actually the story of View Storefront as well. Mm-hmm. The seller, it was growing like a hell. And at some point you decide that maybe we take some additional funding to make it grow even faster. And from your point, like VC, those situations are easier or more difficult to invest into in this situation? And the second question, which is related but not exactly, is that are they more successful or more, you know, more risky?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not really sure there's one answer to it. So I think it comes down to the specific case. Not every open source project should take funding. I think that's very clear. If you invest into an open source company, I think it comes down to the same criteria that we're looking at for any company, is sort of like, what is the ambition level behind it? And if everything goes right, again, how big could that company be become? And I think this is the reason why there's been such an influx into open source as an investment theme, is because if everything goes right and adoption works, right, bottom-up adoption works, these companies can grow extremely fast. And at the same time, I think the majority of those of the products are not to be monetized, and that's also cool, and that's also good, right? This is also what sort of open source is about.
We went very deeply into open source, and maybe that's enough for now. My next question is pretty tricky, because it's about the deals you missed and the deals you are most proud of. Like, so two different, you know, sort of companies.
So I think every investor has a long, long list of deals they missed. And I think we are no different. I think we've missed a bunch of really exciting companies, either because we didn't see them or we saw them and we said no and they became amazing.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, which were the ones we're most sad about. I think the yeah, maybe like in Berlin the last few years, right? We didn't invest into Senda, which is a great business, or a Trade Republic, which is also very successful. Yeah. But I here's the thing. I think you need to be excited about any tech company being successful. I am honestly, I'm truly excited, whether it's our own or whether it's, you know, in, of course you're a little bit more excited if they're in your own portfolio. Of course, I'm not going to lie, but I think generally, I want founders to be successful and I want companies to thrive because I think it's important for Europe. It's important for the ecosystem. So I don't really spend so much time like worrying about what we've missed. Honestly, I think as a VC, you don't have to be right all the time.
Yeah, it's part of the game. You cannot avoid it. It's always a bet, right? So yeah.
No, it's part of the business. And what you said, like, which companies am I most proud of? That's almost as difficult to answer, right? Because it's, you ask a parent, like, what's your favorite child? Right?
You don't need to answer. Okay, no problem.
Well, I can try. I think. So obviously we want all our companies to be successful commercially, but you know, I think the things you get more and more excited about over time is also, you know, companies that really have a positive impact on the world, right? So whether it's an in farm, I don't know if you know the company in Berlin that doing the systems for vertical farming, significantly reducing carbon footprint. Amboss is a company I'm on the board of, a company based in Berlin that is basically building the Google for medicine. So they are improving medical care by providing latest knowledge to doctors and medical students around the world. So these kind of companies, I mean, this is something that, you know, we also really care about a lot. And it's also why I personally also invest in a lot of social entrepreneurship projects. I have a foundation to do that, so I don't do that with Cherry. But also with the Cherry investments, we want not only companies that are financially successful, but that are also successful in terms of the impact. And then these are the ones that, you know, make you proud.
That's awesome. And that's very, very important thing you said, that, you know, sustainable products that making our world better. It's actually, you know, it could be a better reason to be proud of than just financials. You know, I think it's actually easier to be successful financially than to change something in the long run for a better.
Yeah, true. And I think if you see a company where you have the feeling it's only about, you know, financial success, you have to really think about it. Like, do you want to invest? Is this, and, you know, I've come to the conclusion that, you know, we've been doing this for a couple of years now and we only have so many bets that we can do a year. So I'll always try and have both.
Absolutely. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. My last question always is the same. Which tech trends makes you excited? And maybe the other part of this question is which are not? I mean, which are, you know, over and under hype?
So I think I get this question also a lot, right? It's it has to be part of every interview and every podcast. But look, I think the most fundamental tech trend is, at the end of the day, that every company is a tech company. Yeah. And that's something that is changing, is still changing. So for every company, for every enterprise company, for every company, digital transformation is the top priority. And that digital transformation, I think we talked about it today, I think the exciting part is becoming more and more developer-led. So developers are the ones that are making the key decisions. And we look at what are the products that they love, what the product that they use, independent of the industries, right? So that for me is, that's a major trend. And if you look at sort of cloud and the spending there and how that's going to develop over the next couple of years, there's going to be huge opportunities in tech that derive from that, right? And I think particularly if you ask me around industries, well, I'm going to come back to sort of the ones that I'm spending most time on. In fintech, there's still a lot of potential. You know, I look a lot into B2B finance, more also on the infrastructure side, API-first businesses. allowing companies to build superior fintech applications. I think there's going to be a lot of value to be created in the next couple of years. And then the other industry that I'm really passionate about is digital health. And I think that's an exciting one because looking at last year, you had sort of a decade worth of innovation, similarly to commerce maybe, but maybe even more extreme. You had a decade of innovation happening in one year. And, you know, that industry, the health industry, which is, I think, 10% of global GDP, that industry will look completely different 5 years from now, right? Because doctors are, you know, finally they're adopting technology. Patients, you know, they're not happy about the current experience they're getting in healthcare. And technology has to play a huge role in how that industry evolves and how that industry then improves care for people. So I think industry-wise, fintech and health, that those are my two.
That's super interesting.
Yeah, I would pick.
That's super interesting, and I totally agree with you that the way medicine is using tech is gonna change. And the last year I was digging into maybe it's not that fancy topic, but you know, open source hospital management systems. There are a few actually. And what struck me is that even they could be adopted widely, let's say in Africa or in some countries that cannot, you know, buy these med ERPs for millions of euro, millions of dollars. They could be adopted, but they are not. And I think that there's still some, let's say, political / mental / I don't know, barriers of doing some regulations. That's one thing that that needs to change.
We need a revolution from engineers inside of hospital. We really need a revolution. I think the software that's being used is antiquated. It's monolithic. It's you know, driven by the big software house like in Germany, the CompuGroup and these guys. Look at the potential. It's incredible.
Yeah, I think that it actually is. Yeah, that's completely the only thing that is blocking the development. There is all sort of those regulations different from country to country, but always very strict lobbies and all these shitty things. But actually the last year was like, okay, I shouldn't say was great, but because it wasn't, but you know, I mean, it's changed a lot into medtech, and because of the urgency of the solutions that needed to be applied, a lot of barriers went down. So that's probably a good prognostic for the years to come.
Yeah, absolutely. I think who said it? Churchill, right? Never let a good crisis go to waste.
Yeah, so, that is a good quote to put here.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Philip. It was great talking to you. Great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great, Potter. And good luck with everything. And keep up the good work. Really like to see more of what you're doing and building.
Awesome. Thank you. And guys, if you have any questions, feel free to post it under the comments. And don't forget to subscribe our podcast.
Thanks for listening to the CTO to CTO podcast. Make sure you subscribe us on all possible platforms. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube also. So wherever your favorite platform is, that's where you can follow us, and speak to you next week.